Plan Commission work session. First order of business is roll call. Jim Patrick, here. Bill Brannigan?
I'm here.
Bob Berman?
Here.
Jim Hanselman?
Here.
Gary East?
Here.
Braulio Escobar?
Here.
John Updike?
Here.
Dustin Capri and Greg Sutton? No. And Annie McGreen?
Here.
How do you say last name?
McGreenery. Yeah.
Okay. I think I said it wrong first time. Okay. New business is to discuss priorities for updating special parking area requirements. Am I on the right?
Yeah, that was okay. It.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Rock and roll.
Anyway, staff report or?
Sure. Derek Tokos, Community Development. And so it put together a brief memo kind of providing an overview of kind of where we're at. Everybody comes to this at a little bit different place. Many of you have been involved in this for a while, others not so much. And so I try to provide a little bit of context in the memo. Years is fair, Bill. We've been in the trenches together on this. So, you know, we have a parking advisory committee. They'll be meeting again on the 19th of October. And one of the items we'll have on the agenda is to kind of is to work through these issues. And I wanted to bounce some of these concepts off you first. So when the city council adopted the recommendations out of the parking study in 2020, March of 2020, it committed to moving forward with demand management. So this metered zone, hybrid, basically, you know, pay for use of a parking space to improve turnover in the Bayfront. And then to have a further conversation about what might work in Nye Beach and more or less to leave City Center as is right now. And part of that is once the demand management program is in place in the Bayfront, there's an expectation and there's policy language to support it that we would be either reducing or eliminating the off-street parking requirements in the Bayfront because we're moving to and relying upon demand management to address parking. And so that's going to require some changes to the code. I included a copy of our current off-street parking code. That's chapter 1414. Includes the changes actually that were just incorporated coming out of the TSP process, but we didn't focus on the special parking area language, and that's tucked in there. And so these are the three special parking areas we have again. And the special parking area standards apply to those. And so you've got the Nye Beach area, which is described as being bounded by those streets. You have a similar description for the Bayfront and then the City Center. And then it points out that uses within a special area are not required to provide parking required in this section. If a parking district authorized by the City Council is formed in all or part of the special area. In such circumstances, off-street parking shall be provided as specified in the district. Now, for a number of years, we had parking districts. They were a form of an economic improvement district. They were voted on by folks in there to self-assess themselves through a business license surcharge to generate some revenue for parking improvements. It was a very small amount of money, limited ability to do much. And those, per statute, are really not supposed to go beyond 5 years. They're supposed to be for fixed duration. Okay, we want to do A, B, and C projects. We self-assess for that. We get the projects done. You close it down. They weren't supposed to be in perpetuity. And so they sunsetted. I included a copy of a resolution that talked about that sunsetting process. However, the business license surcharge was kept in place by the council. And they also kept in place a provision that still applies in each of the three districts, which is, you know, if you're doing new development or redevelopment, you can generate a demand for up to 5 off-street parking spaces per the ratios in the off-street parking code before you actually have to provide an off-street parking space. So it was a relief valve to allow for some development down there. In Bayfront, for example, or in parts of Nye Beach where you physically couldn't provide the off-street parking anyway. It's just not possible. And so those are still in place, and that's kind of where we're at right now. So I had posed a few questions, and you know, one additional one I put on the top here too is we, you know, I look at those descriptions of the special parking areas, and they leave a little bit up in the air. So you might want to tighten up exactly what the boundaries are. You know, when I went back to this map here, the text descriptions and these maps, we might want to just put a little bit of thought to that, make sure that the language is nice and tight in terms of what the boundaries are. There's no confusion as to whether or not a property is or isn't in a special parking area.
Do you believe those maps are accurate? Meaning where those lines are drawn or where...
I don't know that they're perfect.
Could be described.
Yeah, I don't know that these are perfect. Okay. And so, but we could tighten that up as part of legislative update.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that pictorial representation has to match a written one. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, they're pretty close. I think we should codify that limited off-street parking exemption of up to 5 off-street parking spaces that the council left in a resolution, because that's it's a whole lot clearer if we have it in an ordinance as opposed to a resolution, which is not part of the municipal code. That's just from an implementation perspective. You don't want a standard like that tucked into a resolution that gets lost or buried. You'd rather it in the ordinance with all the other standards that you're dealing with. We should actually note that the special parking areas are required to meet parking standards in that chapter, except as modified. If you're providing off-street parking in a special parking area, we want you to meet the driveway standards, the dimensional standards, all of the other standards that apply if you're actually constructing off-street parking. That's not in there right now. We probably want to add that. You know, we should look at eliminating or further reducing. That's how it was framed in what the council adopted. My preference would be, frankly, to eliminate off-street parking requirements once a metering permit program is implemented, such as what we're going to be doing in the Bayfront. Because otherwise, you're kind of speculating as to, okay, what bar do you set for when off-street parking is needed? And frankly, a heavy user or a use that requires a lot of parking isn't going to locate down there because it doesn't have the spaces to meet their business needs. You know, whether or not we have, I mean, we don't need to have a parking standard down there, and you're going to have businesses making their own judgments as to whether or not that's an area where they want to locate. For example, a high-end hotel, probably not going to locate in the Bayfront. Keep in mind that anything retail, lodging related would be limited to the water related zone where you have conditional use authority review approval anyway. And if it's, you know, not compatible with the area, you can factor that in there. Why try to set a parking standard? That's kind of my view.
Will we be able, under the conditional use things, to require a parking space if they had residential use? See, we got an ordinance that says we can mm-hmm. stack that residential over the top,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's one that you're not going to want to have them parking on the street.
Mm-hmm.
You got a turnover thing, and it's probably not going to work. So for those types of uses, we may want to require off-street parking.
There in those limited cases where
in
you
can
do...
those limited cases
it's
where
pretty,
you got...
Okay, I'll check that down.
I'm not as concerned about the vacation rental ones because I think that works fine. Or, you know, they expect to do that. But somebody who's actually living down there...
They need parking spaces.
Yeah, well, they're gonna be there. I mean, the car is going to be there.
I guess I'd have a difficult time supporting reducing or eliminating the off-street parking requirements. Parking's kind of at a premium. And I think, and I know this is a residential setting, but think about that fourplex, which is just put up just east of Nana's on Northwest 3rd. There's no off-street parking for those fourplexes. They have to park, and now they're competing with the customers of Nana's and customers of the Nye Beach for parking space.
Well, I'll be candid with you. You may recall, you know, the, let's talk about the tin cottages up there by the Inn at Nye Beach.
Okay.
One of my pet peeves.
We heard mumbling and grumbling about how that's going to cause all these kinds of issues. Now, we had within the last couple of council meetings, and I can find the minutes for you, we had the Nye Neighbors Association in here because they were looking for some funds to help them operationally. And so when they came up to testify, Councilor Goble asked them specifically, have you observed any problems with parking there? And they said, nothing. No issues. So, you know, what folks perceive at the time before something's built and what actually happens doesn't always comport.
That might be different than, you know, the ones up there by the Inn in Nye Beach might be different than those spaces immediately east of Nana's. That's a more high impact commercial area.
One of the advantages you have with the difference between residential and commercial, though, too, is that they are often utilizing the spaces at different times.
Opposite ends. So, you know, the residential's in there at nighttime when you're not being used.
These four cottages that I'm thinking of have no parking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's zero parking. They have to park on the street.
Well, that's half a Nye Beach.
Yeah.
It's more than half a Nye Beach is no parking.
But one of, you know, when we implement the new parking thing, it's going to be done in Bayfront first, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Starting next year.
Yeah.
We're not going to do anything with Nye Beach.
Right.
Nye Beach is the following year, potentially.
So work on work on the Bayfront first, which is very critical.
Right.
See how that works and then proceed with the rest of the community.
Right.
Yeah, and
right.
I want to be clear.
That sounds reasonable.
Yeah, we're only talking about putting language in here to eliminate or reduce off-street parking requirements where metering is implemented.
Right.
Yeah.
It would be framed in that way. And that was always part of the trade-off, and that's why it was framed in the policies the council ultimately adopted, which was pursue the metering, and then in these metered areas, reduce or eliminate your off-street parking.
Yeah. And currently, Nye Beach is not thinking of metering. That's been quite a debate down there between metering and non-metering.
Right.
So is that a metering section? Whereas the Bayfront seems to be clearly identified as someplace we are going to put meters.
No, we're not moving forward with metering in Nye Beach. The commitment was to do that in the Bayfront. And then our suspicion is folks in Nye Beach will be kind of gauging how that works in the Bayfront.
Right.
But step two would be engaging Nye Beach, not to push metering, but there is a commitment to talk to the Nye Beach folks more about whether or not the permit program should be expanded.
Mm-hmm. But your statements are about either, isn't that true? Mm-hmm. Eliminate or reduce off-street once metering / permit.
I meant that to be a metering, it's a metering permit combo program. So it's metering and permit.
So that would, if Nye Beach implemented permit parking, this wouldn't apply. I read the / as an or.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do too. And I think you maybe should.
I think we can frame that however we want to frame that in the code. So if we want to just say metering only, or that metering has to be a component for the parking to be lifted, we can make that, build that into the code.
Yeah, I mean, that would at least limit the scope and make this decision a little easier, but then you got to face it again in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Derek, describe what the impact of eliminating might have had on that specialty grocery that didn't get built.
They would have undoubtedly still put some parking in there because they had this, they're one of the few that had the surface area to actually do it. They were looking at putting in quite a bit fewer, you could expect fewer off-street spaces. They wouldn't put quite as many in probably. It gives them a little bit more flexibility in terms of how they size the facility. But they would have put some additional off-street parking to supplement the on-street next to it. That was their plan.
I'm thinking of two businesses, which would be east of the Wax Museum. One is on the corner adjacent to the pump station, and it's basically a breakfast house. And they have a two-lane parking area, which with COVID they converted into outside eating. And then further down, there's a business that's kind of failing, and it's for sale, called the Sail Inn. And it has a bar, restaurant. Upstairs, I think there's two motel rooms they rent out. But adjacent to that, they have a parking lot that would handle six spaces. Now, with those...
Adjacent to the Sail?
At the Sail Inn.
Hmm.
Would that requirement of off-street parking then be eliminated here?
Yeah, the concept would be eliminating the off-street parking requirement. You could see some businesses. I'm going to use the coffee house as the one I can visualize a little bit better, Braulio.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see them permanently converting that driveway that they're using for seating now into outdoor seating. And it won't go back to
parking
for a couple of cars. The concept is with the metering, you're going to get a revenue stream that's actually going to be sufficient enough that we can get vanpool, carpool going. We can get transit going, enhanced transit, or we can save it up for a period of time and make a legitimate run at structured parking or parking that...
But is the parking meter going to generate more rapid turnover of the spaces?
Yes. That's pretty much a proven commodity at this point.
Right.
But
we've looked at a lot of studies. When we went to before this study was ultimately completed, I mean, there's a lot of research on that one. And they're pretty effective at that.
Does it require enforcement for meters to actually be...
Tony Gabarino. Isn't he our community services?
I recognize that. What I'm asking is, does it require enforcement and consequences to get people out of the parking booths? Or do you think most people are compliant? Or is somebody going to pull into a parking meter and park there and put the coins in and then go off for the day? Because, well, I mean, in cities I've lived in, that is an issue. And it's only solved by enforcement.
Well, again, that's...
And that's the thing that we don't do real well at.
Well, we're not currently funding it, but the budget includes funding for enforcement and hiring of an enforcement officer once the metering's in place, because it creates a revenue stream to help pay for that officer. Tickets don't do it.
No.
Never have. I think you typically can pull in 20, maybe 25%.
That's my point. Yeah. So,
but metering, I mean, you're going to generally be largely compliant, and you know, people pay because it's convenient too, and they're accustomed to doing it, and it's the right thing to do. But you'll occasionally have people that don't, like you said.
Yeah.
And that's the key. That's the piece for the enforcement.
Okay.
To go around through and.
What is the residential population of the Bay Street?
Almost non-existent.
Yeah, and that's why I think the competition for parking spaces down there may not be quite what that would be if it were metering were to go to Nye Beach in the future, mm-hmm. where there is a lot more residential demand, and there will be a lot more vehicles looking for parking places. So I don't think those two zones don't have many similarities in terms of the people who frequent there, or in this case, live there. That's a tremendous residential population in Nye Beach that uses street parking. And it will only increase. Yeah, Mr. Parking Man.
I'm on that parking. I spent some time talking to the city of Bend.
Yes.
Talking to who?
Bend. B-E-N-D.
City of Bend.
Central Oregon.
Central Oregon.
Okay.
Near Prineville.
Yeah.
God's
Prine Desert. And they have a full-time parking manager.
My golly.
That's their job, and he's got a couple assistants. But anyhow, part of what the parking management group is going to look at, and Derek is probably have it ready for the next meeting, is there's a lot of parking systems that are already out there. Mm-hmm. Okay? And the parking system that they use in Bend has essentially people pay via their cell phone. Mm-hmm. There's an app. Mm-hmm. There's multiple apps, mm-hmm. and they all key into multiple systems, and that's how they pay. And as part of that app, you key in your license plate number. And in Bend, they have from an enforcement perspective, that actually the vendor pays for, because of their financial arrangement, drives down the street, and the cameras look at the license plates and determine who's in violation and who's not in violation.
They just automatically issue a ticket?
Right. they kind of automatically then can issue, it's not a city ticket. It's a parking district type ticket where they ask people to pay voluntarily. And north of 80% of the people pay voluntarily. And generally, if somebody skips it the first time, they send them a little note saying, you know, shame on you, don't do it again. And if
they're Does that make people, it easier to sit on my cell phone and keep the meter fed using the app?
Well, in theory, except that the zones they have, mm-hmm. some zones in their core business area, 1 hour. Some zones, 2 hours. Some zones, 4 hours. And this is, I mean, they have mm-hmm. parking literally all over the city. So, you can and you can't, but because of that, they can enforce the 1 hour thing. But their 1 hour is just a very small little segment. Not near as big as the Bayfront is. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of systems out there. And as a matter of fact, I think it's the Wax Museum has their own little parking lot up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're doing that.
Yep.
If you want to go into the Wax Museum and you park in their lot, you whip out your cell phone and you pay, I don't know what it is, some fee. And again, the manager of the Wax Museum, he's, getting 85-90% of the people comply. And those that don't comply, it's just,
I have to remember that.
Well, how often are you going to visit the Wax Museum? I mean, you live here. But I mean, so it's, enforcement is, there's going to be some scofflaws. But for the most part, most people tend to be honest. But the revenue stream that they get in the city of Bend is enormous, that they use to fund all sorts of stuff with. And Bend is, it's a tourist city too. I mean, it's bigger,
sure.
But they have a winter tour season because of the snow, and they
sure.
have some summer stuff, so.
I too have a problem with eliminating the off-street parking, but I'm wondering whether there isn't some box you could put around it specifically to address a situation like the grocery store, saying, if you're going to be developing more than so many square feet or, expected traffic is so-and-so, then you must have X number of parking spaces, which could be significantly lower than the normal development parameters we'd require in South Beach, for
example. So if we put some language on eliminate, you'd also like to see a policy alternative that would be for reduce but not eliminate. That's kind of puts a cap on the bigger stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you can say eliminate for all development under X. And I don't know whether X is dollars or square feet or whatever parameter.
Well, I think you take what you've got, but you go by what the anticipated traffic is. I know there's numbers for each mm-hmm. one of those things. Yeah. That's the number you want to use. Pick one of those numbers. Beyond this point, then you're going to have to at least supply some parking.
So the little cafe is fine.
Yeah.
But the specialty grocery.
Generate quite a few trips.
I think we want to think about it, though. We want some bigger players. I mean, there's some property down there along that bayfront we want to see redevelop. The Basics is one, certainly, but where Basics was going to go. But you also have that whole stretch of waterfront property that Peck Seafood has that's falling into the bay. That could be, you know, a substantial amount of development.
Yeah, that's true. That's a nice property.
So just to be clear, though, when we're talking about eliminating the requirement, we're not eliminating the parking. We're eliminating the requirement to provide the parking. But the developer, if it's a larger development, which creates the concern, is going to be driven by lender requirements. I've been through this in both my experiences in Tucson and in San Francisco. Now, San Francisco, let's not talk about that because that's so transit rich. They not only eliminated the minimums almost 20 years ago, but enforced maximums of like 0.3 per unit maximum you can't exceed. So my neighborhood discussions there were the complete reverse of what we're talking about. Don't you dare have a parking space. But in Tucson, a less dense atmosphere, the concerns were the same as what I'm hearing from my colleagues here, that this is going to cause huge problems. But the experience was it didn't. It actually did work, and it was implemented along with permit parking programs, as well as metering. So getting rid of minimums, let the market drive the requirements. You're going to hear from public that will also drive the requirements. And in most cases, it's the lenders for the projects that look at it. Is this financially feasible? You've got to have X spaces for financial feasibility. We don't necessarily have to sit there and demand it.
Well, like
it'll be demanded
basics market. If that
by
goes
the development
down
team.
There, it's going to put parking spaces in it because it wants their customers to come in and buy stuff. Right. And they won't come there if they got to pay meter stuff.
Right. Do we know why that market elected not to go into the old Peptide site?
I think it's because of COVID and everything tanked, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. Just as they were getting started, it's like if you can't keep your existing businesses open, then it's really
hard
to justify opening a new one.
Now with interest rates rising,
yeah,
tough to open something new now.
Well, why don't you give us an option?
Yeah, a couple options.
Look at it.
All right, ADA. ADA, and I'm going to hit EV charging at the same time because they both have kind of a similar. Under ADA gets triggered under the state structural specialty codes. It's building code driven is where your ADA requirements come in, and they trigger only if you're providing parking. If you're not required to provide parking, you're not required to provide an ADA space. We are way low on ADA within the public right of way down there. I can think of one spot along the street right away where we have an ADA space, and that's in the vicinity of Local Ocean on the bay side. I'm thinking we could tackle it a couple of different ways. One, typically ADA is one ADA space for every 25 parking stalls. That's your threshold in the structural code. We could say if you're doing improvements over a certain threshold, and we don't have an ADA space that's within that kind of distance in terms of number of stalls, then you have to provide one within the public space fronting your business. Or, and I think this is probably the better way to deal with it, is the city needs to start programmatically adding those spaces in down on the bayfront. Because if we're not going to have them in the off street, we need to have them in the on street or in our public lots. And I think maybe that's the better way to do it, because we can then put them exactly where we need them throughout the bayfront. And we're going to need to resurface lots like the Abbey Street lot by Rogue Brewery, Lee Street over by the Ripley's, which is the second one up.
Right.
There are a number of lots, Fall Street over there by Pack Seafood.
I was also going to point out your map doesn't include like Lee Street. Picks up Abbey,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't appear to pick up that one that goes up on Lee Street.
Okay.
Nor does it pick up the other one that's, I can't remember what it's on, it's farther down.
Okay.
There's a couple of them that the map doesn't pick up, and it probably should, or else you're just going to have a permanent park vehicles.
They certainly are on the radar of the parking committee as we work on the metering piece, because it was all picked up on the maps that are part of that parking study.
Oh, okay.
In terms of what should happen in what
lot.
I was just
looking at the map that you, you know, the one you had here.
I know, which is a rougher map than what was included.
So
we have much more detailed mapping for the metering.
All right, that makes sense then. Yeah, I just want to make sure we're picking those up.
Sure. How do you do ADA van space on parallel parking?
If you do parallel parking and it's ADA, you can do it, but that then means you have to create a ramp up to the sidewalk typically. So you have to, you're going to have to do some improvement there.
Or on the curb.
But we do actually have a detail for a parallel parking ADA. But
van.
Which
van version of ADA, not car version.
Yeah.
Whether you leave the extra 8 feet with stripes across it and says, don't park
you
here.
You end up having to, I believe you end up, I haven't looked at that detail recently, but I believe you end up having to widen out the sidewalk area. You might have to. You got to create the room for loading and unloading.
Right.
Of the
side wheel. Loading and unloading.
Right, side loading and unloading.
Well, putting them in angled parking just destroys parking places.
Well, so does it anywhere. It destroys
but
a parking place.
Yeah. If it's parallel, it doesn't destroy any parking places.
How do you unload it?
Unload onto the sidewalk. They're not taking any.
Yeah, but you don't have 8 feet of sidewalk down there in places.
No, no, but is that the requirement that you have 8 feet next to the, is that how that
I don't
works?
Have to have, you'd end up having to have more space so that you can accommodate the loading and unloading of the wheelchair.
And also a
parallel passageway. Well, I never needed 8 feet when I unloaded my grandmother, but geez, okay.
But it's in the requirements.
Yeah,
and
that's
then
what
you've
I'm
got,
saying.
You've got
I know because
we
discussed
piece,
it
so.
Specifically with Ripley's, which is an area where actually where we had some wider sidewalk area there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it didn't work out. I don't remember exactly why, but there were, we had kicked around whether or not we could try to squeeze parallel ADA space in that area. So I think the better play on the ADA is, to, and frankly, same with the EV charging, is in the Bayfront where we lean so heavily on public parking assets is to address those needs in the public realm where the bulk of the parking is and do it programmatically with city funding, parking meter funding,
whatever. How do you anticipate having EV charging in an area where you've got parking meters and a limited opportunity to park when EV charging takes a bit of time?
Well, EV charging is actually getting more and more efficient in terms of how much time it takes. You can certainly have EV charging. Level 2 chargers here would be able to charge, provide a significant charge in the kind of time frame that somebody would be parked and enjoying places down at the Bayfront. So somebody going there,
the level
they can plug
2
in.
Isn't that fast, but the Tesla version, which they're supposed to make available to everybody, that's 20 minutes for a full charge.
But the one we just put in here that's about to go live, that's the Blink charging, has very variable kind of recharging.
Oh.
And so it actually is relatively quick even for on the level 2, but it's an advanced level 2 charger.
But isn't
the tech's getting better and better.
Yeah.
Isn't that something that could be provided by private enterprise, like a gas station?
I would hope so, but people don't want to park their car at a gas station as far away from them.
Eventually, I think what you see with EV charging, and I included some information in here, is this last legislative session with the Oregon legislature, they're requiring the infrastructure to go in commercial and multifamily projects over 5 dwelling units. They don't have to put the chargers in, but they have to size their power and they have to run the conduit to support EV charging if they're building parking lot with their project. And that's now in and codified. We got a new rule. I think I may have even included the rule in here from BCD that address building codes division that addresses that. Yes, to your point, yeah, private can, and to a point does. I mean, Tesla's charging, I would put in that category. I mean, they're funding the network to a point.
Well, remember, the Walmart has the chargers. Mm-hmm. You've got the chargers across the street from La Roca. And that motel that we approved down at
Nye
Beach, they had committed to putting in some EV chargers.
Yes.
Now, the chargers at 9th and Herbert are publicly funded. That was part of the West Coast EV rollout, the original West Coast EV rollout, and it was just recently refreshed. That's why you see newer chargers there. The older ones had kind of fallen.
You see the article, right? I read an article, I'm reading too much, about the drain on the power grid in California at night because people are charging their cars at night.
If electrical cars go, well, yeah. Many, I've read many over the last 2 years.
Well, they've simply recommended that they charge it during the day. That's the recommendation from the grid operators. So minor change to behavior. Yeah. People were used to just plugging in when they get home, and instead, and this will require developers to put in further EVs as part of commercial development, because that's when they want them plugged in, is when they're at work. Mm-hmm. If they're not working remotely, if they're working remotely, plugging in at home during the day.
All of that will change once electrical vehicles, I forget the percentage, once they strike a certain percentage, like 20%, the grid across the country won't be able to support that kind of demand. So until we build the grid better and bigger, electric cars are going to be good for those who get them early. But if the grid just doesn't have the power nationwide.
We can't solve that here, though.
Yeah, well, it's like getting a new dam here.
There's
two
things.
It's a grade on the drawing board, you
know. It's been there for 20 years.
Yeah.
There's two things I say. We need to make sure no EV chargers go underneath cover anywhere.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because they have a known ability to catch fire while charging.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Which means also housing is going to be real problematic, too, because you may find out that if you have an EV charger in your garage, they're going to tell you you can't park your car in that garage. In fact, they just did a warning for somebody to not park their cars in the garage.
Because of the charger?
No, because of the cars were catching on fire.
By the car itself, yeah.
By itself, without being on a charger.
Yeah, with a battery. Yeah, batteries are tough.
Okay, to bring to the different issue. Let's refocus here.
Yeah, what do you mean?
Back to parking stuff.
What do you mean by address EV charging needs programmatically? What does the word programmatically mean?
That means taking a look at the off-street parking we have, say, in the Bayfront. And if we want to introduce EV charging, do it in a thoughtful way in the public, you know, as a project that we do for the public parking areas. That is, maybe we add a couple of chargers in a couple of different locations along the Bayfront. But we do that as a city. We don't try to require it on an ad hoc basis as redevelopment happens.
Same way we want to deal with the
ADA
parking. Let the city try to figure out where it's going to work best.
Yeah, and make it happen that way.
Yeah,
best approach.
I just can't see anybody trying to put one off the road bed down there on the Bayfront, other than maybe in the fish plant might work.
Now, loading spaces, I think we want to hold tight to that. If they're generating a demand for that, the size requirements for loading would take out a ton of more parking on the Bayfront. So if Pax Seafood, for example, moves forward with plans of redeveloping that dilapidated section of dock, and it's going to, you know, be a fish plant expansion or something of that nature, they're going to need to factor in room for loading of their vehicles, not assume that they could load it up on the parallel parking, basically, come up with some way of using public space for that purpose.
Yeah, well, technically, they can load in the middle of the street.
Yes.
Which they do now.
Yeah, they do.
That's what we want to avoid.
Sure.
Isn't that part of the charm of the Bayfront?
That's the one area on the industrial side, I think, what we'd want to hold to loading when you're doing a large enough expansion that warrants that. And those thresholds are already in the code, which I include in your packet. The other last one on this topic before we hit the camping briefly is, I think I can pull together some alternative bike parking standards that deal a little bit better with the space-constrained environment down there. And, you know, as opposed to the formal, what we have in the code right now, which assumes you have a little bit more area to work with. So we can probably come up with some standards for addressing that where it's a wall-mounted attachment or something of that nature on a Bayfront business where someone can just, you know, lock their bike, you know, and go into that retail store or that restaurant and not have to have your conventional, you know, kind of what we typically would see with the bike racks.
You're talking about though limiting that to these parking areas or specifically to the bayfront?
But putting into these special parking areas or these are special parking areas because they're space constrained. All three of them are. And so you don't have the kind of room you have elsewhere in the city to put in some of this type of infrastructure. Sure. So to provide some alternatives, some space constrained alternatives would seem to be prudent in these three areas where they can meet bike parking without providing the same kind of footprint you would otherwise.
Could I suggest too that also could be along with this, with what you're recommending,
mm-hmm.
Another programmatic opportunity, maybe bike lockers off street at some point that.
Where we could fit them.
Sort of have a partnering approach to bikes.
Good thought.
We got that little, where that pump station is.
That's a good thought.
Put food carts in there, but that would be potentially a really nice location for that.
We probably ought to put in a charging station for bikes.
I think there's a parking lot there that's pretty much monopolized by the folks who work across the street at the fish plant. There might be a sign that says limited parking.
We've got it blocked out right now.
I know it's blocked out,
but that'll change.
Two summers ago was, and the enforcement was not, the enforcement was sporadic.
I was also thinking that maybe you could do a combination bicycle parking, motorcycle parking, take some stall spaces and do it that way. You know, instead of somebody parking a motorcycle in a car space.
Don't generally you have one motorcycle per space?
Usually they're parking a couple in
if they're
space.
All together.
Derek, somebody just said it, but the whole EV thing probably should have a clause or two about e-bikes and e-scooters and
Motorcycles or BMW.
Or even motorcycles.
BMW has an electric motorcycle.
Yeah, they do. Harley's doing it.
Can you have an electric Harley? I mean, there's something wrong with that.
No, they put a big audio system in there.
Like the whole motor we used to have on our kid bikes. You know?
Moving right along here. We had one other item. This would be the camping item, Jim.
Okay. Oh my God.
I don't want to spend.
Are we going to invite some of the public to help us wrap
No.
the
ordinance?
No, we're not. This is strictly a city council issue. Unless we have to do something that's land use.
You missed the appearance.
Well, there's a land use cleanup, and that's what I want to talk about.
Okay. Here.
No, I heard them.
We didn't touch the land use rules this go around with the camping ordinance because. You know, the council very much would like to get that adopted here pretty soon. If we touch the land use rules, we're looking at 35-day advance notice to DLCD and a hearing before the Planning Commission and Council. It stretches the timeline out. And so what we decided to do was we're going to do a land use fix on the heels of this camping ordinance that's going to soon be adopted. I sent out the latest version from our city attorney this morning. That version has some cleanup items in it. One of the areas was the section that deals with permitted camping. And this is what happens sometimes when you spend an inordinate amount of time on a different section of this ordinance through public meetings, is you forget to go back and clean up a section that you knew you needed to clean up, and that's what we did with permitted camping. The version I sent you earlier had a subsections B and C. They've been cleaned up and merged into a subsection B. The point here is that under the camping ordinance, the camping ordinance is largely limited to public property and rights of way. That's what it's focused on. But it has one area under permitted camping, which gets at what had been the three vehicle camping for homeless provision that you guys have worked on and the council had worked on in the past, which aligned with a state law, which has now been loosened up somewhat at the time. That limited allowance now has, it's for three vehicles or tents on commercial, industrial, public, or property where you have a religious institution or place of worship. And then there's a number of standards, you know, they're to provide bathrooms and storage has to be handled in a certain way, so on and so forth. That's all in the ordinance.
I have a couple, having read through there, having to deal with private or particularly the religious organizations hosting this homeless. I think we need to add in there that at any time the institution can say, can't camp here anymore.
It's in there.
It's in there.
It's in there.
But we don't specify how long the homeless person, or the camper rather, I shouldn't say homeless, the camper has to clear out. We do in the public says, once you're notified, you have 4 hours to clean out. But there's nothing in the other one. So, I mean, I can just foresee them saying you can get out, and the camper says, hey, you know, okay, I'll get out next month or next week.
Well,
we probably ought to put some type of a time limit to have that person out.
I'll pass that along to David or Alan, our city attorney. We do have the ability to trespass off private property, so the trespass ordinance kind of goes hand in hand with this. But I'll pass that along, Bill.
And then the other one is on these private institutions, should we also put in there that they have an obligation to keep the premises clean and tidy,
sanitary,
and remove the trash? I didn't see that in there. And we have enough problem with the VRBOs leaving trash out when they shouldn't, much less. Yeah.
Well, I did see it in here, but I don't know. There's so many documents. I don't know which document.
Yeah, well, I didn't see it.
This is not. He's talking about the ordinance that's already been passed and in effect. Is that true?
No, it's going to it's going to City Council on the. No, that goes to the council for adoption on the 3rd of October.
Right.
Oh, okay. But we're not. We're discussing the other one.
Correct. That's what I'm trying to get to.
Okay.
Can we also clean up the thing that if you don't have permission from a landowner, that they can get you off the property? Okay, because I had a problem across the street from the thing here, where the woods are at, across from the parking lot there. Mm-hmm. I had to have the owner come up, and we went out there and posted signs and gave them notice and still cleaned that up. It's two trailer loads full of crap out of there. Awful. But we had to post it because the police wouldn't enforce it unless it was posted, no trespassing.
Sure.
And was this on Highway 20?
No, this is over here at the parking lot.
Oh,
yeah, that's the we just adopted a trespass ordinance that codified longstanding city policy, and it's going to get tweaked one more time to line up with ordinance 2198 when it goes up for adoption on the 3rd of October. I'll pass that along to Jason about whether or not we need to do something with that. Further on trespass.
Yeah, because I had to look her up, got a hold of her, and then she came up and we got it fixed. And I've got signs up there, and I'm maintaining them for her.
Sure.
So,
will the ordinance allow the campsite that we have on the front lawn now?
No, the ordinance number 2198 expressly prohibits the city hall and other. There's a list of specific city facilities that are open to the public. You can't, and that includes the grounds. It's in
that
there.
Would include the little park, the, what is it, the
sister, the list is the right here park. In 9.05, 9.50.020. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We put it in there explicitly.
City Sisters is included in that.
And I had a couple of questions about those two lists. What is the wayside? The guy's
Ernest
the composer.
Block. Ernest Block.
Ernest
Wayside.
Block. That's not on here. Is that, should it be?
It's not a city facility. That's not a city right away. We don't have jurisdiction on that. That's ODOT.
Okay.
That's Oregon Department of Transportation.
All right. So none of our rules would apply then?
Just like we wouldn't apply to somebody who's camping in the highway right away. It's not our jurisdiction.
Okay.
This ordinance is limited to areas that are under the city's jurisdiction. Same concept applies if it was a county-owned property. We don't have jurisdiction there.
Okay.
Like Mike
under,
Miller. Yeah.
Under the other list, the facilities, it's got the main fire station, but it doesn't have either of the other two. And I know one's behind a gate, but ours is not.
The North Fire Station?
Yeah. Shouldn't that be on there?
It's not really one right now that the public has access to. We tried to limit it to stuff that really has public access to it. 70, that's not even a fully manned facility at this point in time on 73rd.
It's going to be when it gets redeveloped.
Well, then it's a joint use facility with the state of Oregon. I mean, it's, so it's a state. Oh, and they own it. We won't own it at that point. It won't be a city property. It'll be a state property that we lease space out of. So it's a little bit,
It's a little bit different. Okay, I have a big picture question though. I mean, this is all a camping ordinance.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be anywhere any distinction between homeless type camping in a vehicle or a car and the kind of camping that I do with my RV. So if I roll into town in my RV and I abide by all of this, sounds to me like I can sit there, well, if, as long as I make it through the first 24 hours, I can sit there for another 3 days.
Yeah, you can.
And not pay any RV park fees, just dry camp there.
That's a function of
the... You can go to Ernest Bloch.
I think that's where the courts came down on this, you know, in the Boise v. Martin and then the Grants Pass case too. And then you had the legislation that came out the last legislative session. I mean, we're talking about people having a right to rest. You know, whether or not they're homeless is not material to that determination, at least from the court's perspective.
You know, but we've got a state park to the south, a state park to the north.
Yeah, but they all charge.
Pardon?
They all charge. And I've met many RVers.
To the north and the south.
I met many RVers who take great pride in paying the least number of nights on any given trip possible. That's why Walmart is such a big deal all the way across the country, except here where they have a sign posted it's violation of the ordinance to live overnight in your RV on their lot, so they don't allow it. Well, they do allow it, but not officially.
I mean, the operative here and the reason, you know, we're getting this 2198 in place, and it's been iterative, it's taken time, and you know, we've, within the last few months, finally had guidance coming from the League of Oregon Cities as to how jurisdictions can respond to this in a manner that's not going to tie you up in the courts for the next 3 years. We have to provide place for somebody to go to. We can tell them you can't be here, but we can't say you can't be everywhere. We have to, you know, and so that's part of it. And then if, and this is still, I mean, we have work to do on this front. If we actually had a shelter where we could send somebody who's homeless, say, hey, look, you can't sleep here, but you can go, we got a shelter bed over at this nonprofit, then we'd have a little bit more leeway in terms of what we can do. So.
And then if that person says, I don't want to go there, it's a high barrier shelter.
That's their call at that point. And the courts just said you had to have a place you could send them, not that they want to necessarily go there. And in many cases, many homeless individuals won't for a variety of reasons.
And Bob, if you park your RV on the street, after a day, there'll be little red marks around your tires.
From?
There are a number of RVs in town that seem to move from place to place. And after they've been there for a while, it looks as though the community service officer is spray painting around the tire so they know how long it's been at that particular location.
Right, but there's no limit at the moment. Especially if I make it through the first 24 hours, I'm an established campsite. And I know I got at least 72 more hours, according to this ordinance, before they can throw me out.
If we can move past 2198, which is actually going to the council, and you really don't have a whole lot of influence on that one right now, although I'll pass on these comments that came up here. I did want to talk briefly about what's in the zoning ordinance that you probably want to clean up a little bit, since that's not part of 2198, but it's still relevant, because 2198, again, is almost exclusively targeted to public property and rights away, with that one allowance for the three-vehicle tent stuff. So anything else relative to, quote-unquote, camping, particularly on private property, kind of falls under the purview of the zoning ordinance. And so here's what the lay of the land is in the zoning ordinance. You know, when it comes to commercial or industrial property, camping is defined, you know, where a fee is charged or there's some sort of trade in exchange for allowing somebody to camp there or patronage of some sort. And in those cases, it has to be in a park, manufactured dwelling park, RV park, state park, or local park, where the state or local park allows it. But that's tucked into kind of an obscure part of our code. It's on the use categories in the retail, service, commercial. We probably want to make that a little clearer in the code. And then when it comes to accessory, really it's, I mean, to residential, it's really our accessory use rules that fly there. I mean, it's historically, it's been fairly common. Somebody can have somebody in a tent in their backyard for a period of time. That's always been viewed as accessory to the residential use. They'd be using the restrooms, the dining in there. More often than not, it's somebody's family members who are staying in a tent in the backyard during summer seasons when the weather's better.
Kids having a camp out.
Kids camping out. We can't distinguish who gets to stay in the tent. That gets into the place where we really have to stay out of that regulatory-wise. But you may want to say one tent or two tents. Put some sidebars on it, because up at this point, it's left to us administratively to say, is that customarily accessory and incidental to the primary use of the property, which is residential? The other question is, do you even want to entertain allowing tents to go up on residential lots that don't have a dwelling yet? They're just undeveloped lots. You know, so I'll stop there on those two.
Well, I'm certainly not interested in more than one tent, but I think another qualification should be size, because I don't want my neighbor putting up a 20 by 30 picnic tent, which they could do. It's a tent.
Mm-hmm.
And they could house however many family members, or maybe they're a homeless advocate and they're trying to help a bunch of people. I don't know, but given the opportunity, people will
push the rules.
Yeah, they will. And push, so, you know, putting in a size, a tent no larger than 10 by 12 or something like that. That's a reasonable size tent.
You'd have to put some
some
caveats on that. Obviously, I could have a wedding with 100 people and rent a tent.
Well,
I don't want you coming over and saying, oh, that tent's too big.
I agree. But but if it's if it's a tenting overnight kind of thing, most. I've been to some wedding receptions that made it through
the 3 days.
Let's not talk about those. But I also wonder, you know, whether these people, these private landowners, should be carrying some kind of insurance.
Is this the problem today with the ordinances written? Has it been a problem? Are we creating a response to something that's really not?
I don't think we're creating a response. It is and will continue to become more of an issue as we have more and more folks looking to find some place to shelter. So the clearer we can be about it, I think the better in terms of what is or isn't permitted. I don't see it going away.
Well, my opinion about the empty lot thing is yes, absolutely, and there should be camping setup of whatever type
on a
that's allowed. I think with our absolutely painful lack of housing, it's really affecting a lot of people. Just in the last 3 days, I've run into two different people that absolutely couldn't find a place to live. And it's just, now I know our friend Lee would have said, oh, there's plenty of housing and people just aren't looking and, you know, being too picky. But I've got somebody living in a house next door to me, which is normally empty, who moved to town to take a job and absolutely could not find any place to live.
Yeah.
Fortunately, she knew the people that owned the house, and they said, you can stay here for a couple of months while you look. So I think as many opportunities, as many doors, and RVs have doors, as our friend Dustin would say. So I'd support some kind of fairly tight regulations, but allowing camping on empty lots when available. I have an empty lot,
and
I might want to consider that.
I can't go along with that unless there are sanitary facilities on that lot. One of the hardest things you have to deal with is public health. and there's enough human feces scattered through the woods and parks here. I don't wish to contact anymore, and I sure don't want it on a vacant lot next to me.
Well, that's fine, but you don't have a self-contained RV either.
Well, I understand that.
I can stay in my RV,
talking,
water, gas, fuel.
That's fine.
And
but if you
waste for a week.
If you allow tents on a vacant lot, that's not a
self-contained.
Well,
maybe we need to make that distinction.
I'm just saying public health needs to be considered in that scenario.
Yeah, but I don't think that's I don't believe that's a reason to not consider this.
Well, maybe you make it it's tents, but the tents have to have, wherever the tent is, it's an empty lot, it has to have access to a place that has sanitary facilities. Makes sense. Because most of the time it's an empty lot adjacent. If it's a lone empty lot not connected to anybody else's stuff, then no, you can't put a tent on it because there's no sanitary.
That'll address the circumstance. Jim, that's a fair point to raise because you have, but the scenario you're talking about, Chair, is where, you know, you have a home with two lots, houses on one lot and the other lots next door, and they have ready access to the dwelling. I've had so many calls over the years about those undevelopable lots on the bluffs overlooking the ocean as you head up, you know, especially up in the Agate Beach area, that they can't be developed. And how many times they've said, well, can I just pitch a tent there? And there's no sanitary facilities anywhere there. I mean, and the terrain is such that it would be difficult to even bring in porta potties if you were going to try to do something like that. Those you probably don't want to see camping on because you're going to have just exactly what you're talking about, then sanitary issues down there.
Yeah.
I appreciate that you're trying to get ahead of the potential problem. I don't think we want to adversely impact the traditional use that families have had of having, you know, the kids camp out overnight or the relatives come and camp out in their backyard and make it overly restrictive for those uses that have been traditionally allowed in this and other communities.
So Derek, I thought the Eugene example that you provided tended to address, you know, most of the concerns I've heard, that subsection B may sleep in the backyard of single family residence, residential zoning district with permission of the owner. Not more than one family may sleep in any backyard, not more than one tent or camping shelter sleeping in the backyard.
Isn't that word family, though?
They
pressed on the word family and then went into defining it as well.
We could change that to number of individuals or something. Yeah, the Oregon legislature just put it
across.
A little differently, but yeah, I think the concept, though, seems like that's what I'm hearing we'd like.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. The other topic was the RVs, Bob. Currently, we do not allow an RV to be occupied when it's on a residential lot or any other lot, frankly, unless it's in a park or it's under that three vehicle allowance that's under ordinance 2198. So you have to either be in a park or the homeless camping option, but you can't live in an RV, and that is a constant that is regularly enforced because it is an issue and the most common one example right now I can think of where it's a relative who's staying in a tent trailer and because they have no place to go, but it's not permitted under current rules. And then that particular case, as I recall, the owner's talking about having another family member come out. So that's where it'd be another one. And we're dealing with it on a complaint basis because neighbors are upset about it. So it's just a regular enforcement issue. So I just want to put it out there. This is a real one, and I don't know, where do you want to go with it on the RVs? I mean, you see jurisdictions a lot.
I'd like to see there be some mechanism where that can happen to hopefully potentially address in one small way the housing shortage.
Well, you see it allowed, and I think I included, it may have been Eugene has that in their example, or one of them did at least, where it could be one vehicle in the driveway. And then the driveway makes some sense, too, in that then you're not having somebody set up in a location that, say, is right next to, you know, a home next door where they weren't accustomed to seeing vehicles. I mean, in driveway, you're accustomed to having a vehicle in a driveway, but I don't know. That'd be one way to tackle it.
I don't see a need to change the existing ordinance.
Okay.
Well, I think you're eliminating the possibility if you don't. That may, you know, what do you get, 10 people that can't currently find housing that way? Lady that moved in next door to me, if I decided I wanted to pull my RV onto my empty lot and say, hey, stay over there. I'll take care of all the utilities and the septic and the, well, all those kinds of things. And
yeah, allowing the connection to your wastewater.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about driving it down to the dump station once a week.
Okay.
And I don't see any reason that we shouldn't do that. Again, it's just a minor thing, but it could help contribute to the critical housing shortage.
I kind of like to see options. One, sticking with what we got. One, talking
about. All right, policy
Bob's
options
talking
on
about,
that.
And then see what the public says. Because this will go to a hearing and.
Oh, yeah.
See what they say.
I mean, there's a reason every house I own that is within an HOA, the HOA restricts or basically eliminates the ability of parking an RV on the property unless it is fully sheltered. And that's because of the complaints from neighbors.
But so that's our current, that's our actually our current one right now.
Exactly.
Yeah. The same thing.
There's a reason for that.
But there's not
I can,
a lot of
I can point you places all over town where they're sitting.
Yes. But I assume but that's driving
people get along with their neighbors.
Two RVs but on Highway 20, which have apparently been abandoned.
Yeah.
Between Newport and Toledo.
Mm-hmm. Well, that one of them burned up the other day. Is it still there?
Burned up?
Well, we came by and there was smoke pouring out every window and door.
They put the fire out, but it's still sitting there. Okay. I came by after they were cleaning it up.
On that policy option, if it were to be permissible, you're talking about one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, otherwise we have RV parks all over town.
I think it would probably be appropriate to say can't be charged for.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to set up an RV park, even if it is only one.
Yeah, I would agree with you, although I do find, candidly, our code enforcement folks would say the same, is that's all so hard to ferret out sometimes.
Well,
not somebody's charging money for something, but it's a fair point. Still worth putting the language in there. Anything else on this topic?
Back on the 2198, but you don't want to hear that.
Hmm. We've exhausted 2198.
Let it go.
Let's talk more about electrical vehicles.
There was only one thing on the work program I wanted to point out. We do have a joint work session with the City Council on the 14th of November.
Ooh.
It'll be your regular work session. And Beth Goodman will be coming out because we're going to need to start moving the housing capacity analysis piece of that through the adoption process. It'll be all housing.
So it's a joint session. We get to sit in the audience while the City Council sits up here.
Oh, we may set up. We'll set up. It's your meeting.
Okay.
We'll probably set up a large table, Jim, right in the middle here. For everybody.
Or we'll bring some tents.
Well, it's our meeting.
That's all I had.
Police action going on.
Thank you, Sherry.
You got to say adjourn.
Hey, Jim. Adjourn?
We're adjourned.
Adjourn. Okay. There's some kind of police action. I have one or 20 and Arnie next to the